How about a little extra?
Hardcore history.
As many of you listeners know, we have been struggling with getting enough content out to you, and I've told you many times we're going to try some new things to try to increase our output. Not just that, we've been trying to do extra shows that we could charge a few bucks for as a way to maybe get a few more bucks. And I couldn't figure out a way to do those extra shows. I mean, I have ideas in my head, but if I can't get out regular episodes in a timely manner, how am I going to do that while making, you know, irregular, paid-for episodes? So, after many suggestions by many listeners and a lot of homegrown ideas and thinking that we came up with, we thought maybe an idea that would fly, and we don't know, this is a lot of this is about testing the waters here and see what you like and what you don't like and what works and what doesn't work. But a lot of the ideas that both parties had centered around this use of material that is a byproduct of making any one of our large shows, right? There's a ton you could still say about all these subjects we bring up, but not necessarily a large audience for it. I mean, the last program we did was Hardcore History number 41. We called it Thor's Angels. I planned for it to be a nice hour and a half long, and by the time we were done, it was 4 hours and either 2 minutes or 5 minutes, somewhere in there. Now, if I had more Thor's Angels for you, how many people do you think want to hear it? I don't know, but we figure rather than put out this on the regular feed, we would make this extra Hardcore History. And maybe we would call it that. And I like the double, you know, meaning of the word. It's extra because it's more hardcore history, but it's also extra because this is even deeper. I mean, if you're hardcore, you listen to the regular show. If you're really hardcore, you'll spend a couple of bucks and you'll listen to more of it. That's okay. You're not the only ones who are a little kooky here. I mean, after all, I'm the guy who read it all and has it all ready to give to you. So we're all in the same club. Maybe it's a club of either history majors or people that would have made good history majors. In any case, here's what we envision, and I don't pretend to know how this whole thing will evolve over time. I'm consistently wrong on this point, so I've learned to just sort of go with it. But here's the plan, at least initially. What's the old line from the German general? Who is it? Was it Moltke? Moltke the Elder, I believe, who had that great line that no, it could have been Schlieffen, but I think it's Moltke that had that great line that says, no plan of battle survives first contact with the enemy. All right, well, this is our plan of battle, and we'll see how it does once we're in combat. The plan is to combine a couple of different strands and do a show after the show you just heard. Think about it like one of those television shows where, you know, you'll see the movie and then afterwards there'll be a panel discussion where the director will talk with someone and they'll say, well, now, what were you thinking when you did this? And were there any scenes you left out? And what were the challenges you faced? I have other podcasters who ask me these questions all the time, so it's probably worth doing a little bit of insider stuff on it and figuring that if you paid for this and you downloaded this extra hardcore history content, you can stand hearing some more. So we'll give you that. We will also throw in stuff that was on the cutting room floor, and I hear this from people all the time. Why don't you just take all the stuff that you didn't use and put it into another show and we can have it? It's not that easy. But in this format that I'm envisioning, we might be able to just sort of throw it out there for what it's worth, sell it for scrap. I have a lot of partial ideas, too, things that we realized early on wouldn't make, you know, wouldn't fit into the narrative the way we were designing it. Some of my best stuff, this isn't necessarily second tier stuff. It's not like I did a triage thing and said, okay, I'll put all the best stuff in the show and all this stuff I leave out is second rate. Sometimes the stuff on the cutting room floor is the best stuff I have. I just can't squeeze it into the narrative, or for one reason or another, it didn't make it into it. So we'll talk about some cutting room floor stuff. We're also going to try something that is important to me. I don't know what the reaction will be on the part of the audience, but as many of you probably know, I've always had an interest in military history. And many of these stories we go into have military history angles that are fascinating. Not all of them, but many of them. I would love to be able to talk and go a little deeper into that, you know, as a fan, obviously, but I don't want to subject the vast majority of people who listen to the Hardcore History program to that sort of military minutia. If you're paying for this and downloading it, I assume you want a little extra Hardcore History with some military sauce on top, and that's what we're going to give you here, too. I'm going to go into a little bit more depth, and again, not as a, this is just an off-the-cuff thing. We're not planning this, so it's just going to be me talking about this stuff. You know, not organized, off the cuff, and we'll see if you like it. One more thing I should point out that this allows me to do, I love the idea of being able to make some corrections. You know, if something in Hardcore History 41 was not right, I would love to be able to say in this program, by the way, you know, this, that, or the other thing, I want to clarify a point, and I just might do that in a few minutes. So that's what we're thinking here with this extra Hardcore History concept. The idea is to make it really cheap, you know, $2, $3 price point, somewhere in there, and see what you think of it. And, you know, is it worth, you know, your time? We'll find out together. If it did work, boy, this would be a nice way to sort of make more use of research we'd already done and, you know, get a couple of bucks off the side, which would really help. You know, we podcasters are always looking for revenue streams, and so many of you business people in the listening audience have donated your thoughts and your mental energy to helping us come up with ideas, and we are so grateful. So we'll try this and we'll see what happens. In addition, as I said, we're going to try some other ideas that hopefully let us get more content out while you're waiting for the really big, hard to do, complicated shows. Thor's Angels, which took 3 months to do, would not have been such a big deal had you had one or two or two and a half pieces of other hardcore history content while you waited. Part of the problem is you're not getting anything for several months. That's too long to wait. We're going to see if we can fix that. We're also going to see if we can fix my desire to have some optional pay-for downloads without, you know, taking extra time or much extra time to do it. I guess the first thing to say is to explain what happened with Thor's Angels. First of all, we are shocked by the good reactions. I have to admit to being somewhat scared when we released it. I was scared because I didn't want to put out another big, long show. We have people that don't like that. Part of our problem with this program is we have a crowd of people who all like different stuff. And I told my producer that this would be a great thing in most industries, right? If we were at Hardcore History here producing breakfast cereal, and we found out that some in the audience want the regular brand and some want the chocolate-covered brand and some want the, you know, Hardcore History with crunch berries, this would be a great thing, right? We would just set up multiple lines of production and we would fill that need. It's a lot harder when we have only one kind of cereal and I have to switch to be another kind. And if I switch, I'm disappointing someone who doesn't maybe like crunch berries, and so here we are. In any case, what happened with this show was I thought I had organized this whole program to be a nice, concise, easy, biographical show on the Emperor Charlemagne. Now, you longtime Hardcore History listeners will know that this means I'm now batting 1 for 3 in my attempt to do biographical Hardcore History episodes of historical figures whose names begin with the letter C. We managed it on the Winston Churchill program when we did Thoughts About Churchill a while back. Then I thought I'd do one on Cleopatra, you may recall this, and couldn't figure out where, you know, where you have to begin the Cleopatra story. Turned out we had to begin the Cleopatra story, you know, with the whole decline and fall of the Roman Republic. And if you heard that 15-plus hour audio book, you'll know that we barely got to Cleopatra at all. Now knowing how we had a tendency to grow out of control, we put some effort into this latest program so that that wouldn't happen. Sat down, listened to a bunch of old shows, and took notes. Thought to myself, how did I do this in an hour or an hour and 10 minutes? Let me remind myself, because you evolve past certain points, right? Listened to it, put notes up all over, realized where we were having problems and where things got out of hand, and deliberately sat down to do this nice tight hour and 15 minute or whatever it was going to be Charlemagne episode. You ended up, as I'm sure you know if you're listening to this, with 4 hours and 2 or 5 minutes of stuff that included very little Charlemagne. This scared us, and it scared us because it's one thing to have a show get out of control when you weren't expecting it. It's another thing for the show to get out of control when you were expecting it and had organized everything to prevent that from happening. We did our absolute best to keep that show nice and tight and short, and look what happened. Yikes. As I said elsewhere, I think, I don't mind the occasional audiobook, but I don't want to be in the audiobook business, especially not with an audience that is conditioned to expect podcast episodes, you know, episodic podcast episodes, to come out at a much more reasonable pace. As I've said before, I think an audiobook every 3 months is, you know, pretty good output. A podcast every 3 months, not so much. So after the show got out of hand, we figured, you know, you just got to do the best job you can. And there were a bunch of ideas that fascinated me and that I wanted to play with and that just didn't work. I'm going to introduce one of them to you now. And I think you'll see what I mean about, you know, how hard it was to really go into that idea without taking the show in a completely different direction. It involved this medieval mindset, and we managed to slip in the words Orwell and 1984 in the episode to point out how different this mindset seemed from the Greek and Roman world, right? And we've said before in the program many times, there's something wonderfully modern about the Greeks and Romans. And the funny thing is if you go back and you read it, you think, this isn't very modern, Dan. But then if you compare it to other things from, you know, a millennia or two ago, you see that the Greeks and the Romans, as just one example, are a lot more like us than a lot of other people. Case in point, these Western European medieval folks. If you delve into it deeply enough, and I've studied this period for a long time, this was nothing unusual for me. Sometimes I have to do a lot more work in understanding a period. But I'd forgotten, kind of, so much Greek and Roman will do that to you, how, you know, sort of closed-minded a world this is compared to what came before. You know, the Greeks and the Romans, you go and you look at their societies and you see all kinds of diversity, diversity of religious beliefs, diversity of thoughts, diversity of outlooks, you know, all kinds of things. That stuff starts disappearing in Northwestern and Central Europe during this Dark Age and medieval period. It becomes, you know, and again, I didn't want to say this because, you know, you could quibble with it, but it reminds you of like a North Korea today. Or really, it reminds you of almost some of the totalitarian states in the 20th century, where thoughts were criminalized and you had to, you could go to re-education camps or worse if you thought the wrong way. I mean, you think of like the Khmer Rouge who took over in Cambodia and created the killing fields and all that stuff. Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting that the situation was as murderous on a regular basis as that, but the whole idea was somehow that it's all about, you know, converting you into a different kind of person, and that starts with your thoughts. And this whole idea of having, you know, someone who's watching you all the time and looking for mistakes and wrong thinking, and also this idea of confession. I thought, you know, when we were looking at the Catholic faith, and thinking about some of the elements in terms of this idea of a thought control society, the confession ritual is fascinating. I mean, all I could think about was how the 20th century ideological totalitarian societies that wanted to control the way you thought too, how they would have gone weak in the knees over having, you know, confession built into their system. And this idea that if you didn't confess, it would somehow affect your immortal soul forever. I mean, what would a Joseph Stalin have done with something like that? The reason we didn't go there too much, though, other than to point out that you have to understand that either these people in the Middle Ages thought in a much more confined, narrow way, you know, like I say, think of like a North Korea, or they weren't allowed to express, you know, their normal humanness, which was lying under the surface. It's like going to one of those communist countries. You know, go to Hungary in the 1960s, and it looked drab and gray and, you know, and the whole thing, this whole conformity of ideas. But you open up the door and you go into one of the homes and boom, you know, things were colorful and lively and it came alive. Sometimes these societies have a, you know, cult-like thought control 1984 Orwell thing going where people really almost are different. And sometimes that's just a facade where none of that's coming through to history because a guy like Gregory of Tours doesn't feel comfortable, you know, saying what he really feels. That's not kosher, pardon the pun. And so you don't know. But I didn't want to go into that too much because I didn't want to imply that this was somehow something unique and special involving Christianity or Catholicism. Because really, it could involve any other major religion you could think of, you know, most of them. I mean, someone might say, well, Dan, you know, Buddhism wouldn't do that. But most religions in history, if they're controlling the state and become the only religion allowed, would be very thought control-ish. And not just that, it doesn't even have to be a religion. It could be a philosophy or an ideology. And we've seen this, right? I mean, the Soviet Union in the 20th century, I can't think of a less religious regime than that. But same thing, sort of a state allowable, you know, thought process. And you would get this in any kind of a system where you weren't allowed to be a free thinker. And as someone who's always, I mean, I can't even imagine myself personally another way to live. I found this to be the most hard part of the medieval world to grasp in the early, you know, late antiquity, early Middle Ages, that period that used to be called the Dark Ages. The hardest part for me was getting into their mindset, The Greeks and Romans, you could understand, when it came to something like religion, they were notoriously tolerant most of the time. What's more, a lot of the Greeks and Romans, especially by the later periods that we most celebrate, there was a lot of a wink and a nod with religion. You got this feeling like there were some people who were really devout, just like in our society, some people who were atheists or agnostics or questioners. There were all these religious things you had to do as part of the pillars of society. You had to sacrifice to the gods, and the, you know, there are all these rituals. But you got the feeling that a guy like Julius Caesar, whose job it was to hold that ceremony as the head of, you know, their religion for a while, that he didn't believe it. Reminded you of modern times a lot, right? Lots of different religious faiths. You get to Dark Age Europe, and it's not like that anymore. But you can't get into the mindset of the people. The sources just aren't there. And like I said, if they were, you get this feeling in the same way we said that the monks in medieval history, exercised some editorial control over what manuscripts got copied and saved for the future and what ones didn't. You get the feeling like there might have been some of that in terms of the writing of the time. You know, stuff that just, you couldn't write stuff like the Greeks and Romans did. From a mental acceptability standpoint, the confines of free thinking had narrowed quite a bit. I should point out, as a correction from the last show, that we made the statement somehow that the monks of Europe are the ones who basically preserved all of the classical tradition so that we could have it in modern times by copying and all that kind of stuff. Well, of course, it wasn't just the monks. In Byzantium, they were copying like crazy as well and saving a lot of old stuff. But what I really wanted to point out was, you know, right after the show, I'm thinking to myself, I want to look something up. I look something up, and right there, something hit me, and I just went, oh, why didn't I say that too? Which is that in the Muslim world, too, they had Islamic scholars who were translating classical text and helping to keep that stuff alive. The monks are the most famous people. There was a book that came out a decade or two ago called How the Irish Saved Civilization. And as much as we with Irish blood would love to latch onto a statement like that, what it really is showing you is how the monks in Europe helped save civilization. And what we don't want to rule out is how the Byzantines and the Islamic societies did the same thing. The monks just get the lion's share of the credit. The other idea that I couldn't get out of my head, it was the one I had the most fun with in my mind, but it was totally undeveloped and unfinished, had to do with my playing a what-if game, you know, about the Enlightenment and the Reformation. And, you know, the wars between church and state. You know, when a guy like Galileo comes forward with some scientific ideas that clash with church teachings, and we had this period of struggle between all that, and we here in the enlightened scientific West tend to look back on that era as inevitable. And the outcome is inevitable. And for a while in that episode we just did on Thor's Angels, I really wanted to go into the question of, well, what if it had gone the other way? In the battle between, you know, science and the church, or the Enlightenment values and the church, what if the church had won? And so I had this idea of playing with, you know, the United Christian States of America and the Holy Catholic European Union every morning. You know, in 2012, first thing you get on the Skype conference call with the Pope, coordinate your message for the day. And I had this whole idea, what would the world be like if the Reformation and the Enlightenment and all that stuff had gone a different way? And it's so common to hear people play with the what-if scenario. What if Rome had never fallen? But think that the idea that maybe science might have been squashed by religious belief or any of that was impossible. Listen, I'd say that that was more likely than the Roman Empire never falling. And believe me, if the Roman Empire hadn't fallen, I'm not so sure you wouldn't have had the church crush the Enlightenment values, because I'm not sure the Roman Empire would have been too hip on the Enlightenment values. Just my way of thinking. In any case, I was looking forward to having a lot of fun playing with that idea, and it didn't fit into the program. The other thing that almost happened, and that I kind of still love to get into someday, is getting into the nuts and bolts of the whole process of converting the German pagans. I mean, there's wonderful stories. We could have gotten into, and maybe we will a little bit more into the program today, about Wittekund and and Charlemagne's wars against the Saxon pagans, too. It's fascinating stuff. One thing I wish I had done is, when we were talking about Charlemagne's execution of the 4,500 Saxons at Verdun, I wish I had used... it's got a couple of names associated with it. My favorite is the Bloody Verdict of Verdun. And, you know, some things just don't make it in the program because I don't have a script. And I wish I'd use that. It gives you a feeling for, you know, the colors of the event, I guess you could say, you know, the bloody killing ground, the bloody execution ground. It is an almost, I mean, again, I'm hoping, and I think I've said this to you people before, I'm hoping that life on Earth has been videotaped by people from other planets, and at some point in my lifetime, they'll come down here and introduce themselves. And, oh, by the way, drop off tape. Oh, that bloody verdict at Verdun. Oh, yeah, that's tape 100,047, you know, the first 30 minutes. I know, who wants to see that? But it's all, I guess what I'm saying is I can't physically imagine these things, and so at some point, there's going to have to be some pictures is all I can say. Somebody on the message board, by the way, it's a funny line because I don't think about it this way, was posting on the discussion board as he listened to the last Hardcore History episode. And he said something like, I forgot what the time was, but something like, you know, 19 minutes into it, aliens, meaning, you know, every show we do, somehow the aliens are involved. What I like about the aliens, just so you know, folks, is if you're talking about Earth's human history, and there are times where you want to take three steps back to get some perspective, right? See it as a newbie might see it. You have to be someone who's not a part of Earth and the human race. The only people who could see Earth's history in any sort of non-biased clinical way would be somebody that wasn't from Earth. Now, one of the things we didn't get into in the program very much was the military side of things. You know, from the early Germanic armies to the armies of the Merovingians to the military situation at Charlemagne's time. And, you know, Charlemagne, and I'm assuming a certain amount of knowledge on your folks' part, especially if you just heard the program, but Charlemagne's period is a really unique period in Western European history. And as we said in the show, his reign was relatively short as emperor. Of course, he reigned quite a long time as the king of the Franks as well. And he tried to change the Frankish armies and the way that they had been. In some sense, the Carolingians are like a proto-knightly army. You know, if you think of the knights that are about to, you know, take over the European fighting scene very soon, the Carolingian heavy cavalry, the Frankish cavalry, is sort of an early incarnation, the beta version of the knightly form, I guess you could put it. Historians and lay people and everyone in the world disagrees on when you can finally classify Western European cavalry as knights. I think I've probably fallen the very non-controversial majority by suggesting that maybe in 1066, when the Normans invaded Great Britain and the Battle of Hastings happened, that you're probably dealing with knights there. They called themselves milites, not knights. Nonetheless, some of these Western European societies never called them knights. So it's sort of a judgment call. People are pretty convinced, though, that the Carolingians represent an earlier evolution of the knightly form. For example, they didn't use the couched lance, the famous lance held under one arm, you know, and the weight of the horse giving you an impetus that makes it extra nasty. The Carolingians were using spears, certainly, but also swords. The Frankish sword was famous, probably the best European sword of the period, and was in such high demand. I mean, one of the things that was a minor theme I thought I could throw in and just never got to in the program was about how even this world had its own version of non-proliferation. I mean, in this day and age, we're always talking about keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of, you know, nations or peoples we don't think should have them. In Charlemagne's time, it was preventing the high-tech stuff that the Franks had from falling into the wrong hands. Traffic on Frankish swords was heavily regulated, and people could get in real trouble taking Frankish swords and, for example, giving them to the Vikings. And the Vikings got their hands on quite a few of them anyway. You find them in the graves of some of the richest of the Viking figures that they find. The Frankish sword is, you know, the one to have. That's what this proto-knightly Frankish cavalry was in large part wielding. And this gets into another subject that I really kind of wanted to examine in the program and never got around to it. It's the question of warlike nature. You know, we talked about the Germans and their stereotypically, you know, warlike qualities, right? And I think we made a point, and I think we made it clear that this is the way they're viewed. I wanted to get into more about what that even is. What's a warlike? Are there warlike peoples and non-warlike peoples, or more warlike peoples and less warlike peoples, and are warlike peoples better at fighting than non-warlike people? We just never got in the program. I have a theory, my own theory, and I'm happy to change it the minute anyone shows any different evidence, because I'm not wedded to it. But it kind of goes along the line of natural selection a little bit, but not in the social Darwinian sense, much more in the question of competition. You know, what do people react to and what do you have to have? I'll give you an example of what I mean. You look at Germany on the map, and people have made the point forever that it's a difficult to defend area. You're right in the middle of a lot of other peoples. You're on the way from one person to another. It's going to be a place where battles happen. Not just that, the natural and defensible frontiers in Germany are not good. Some countries are easily defendable. Germany's not one of them. Any people that is going to manage to survive in that area is going to be tough, because if they're not tough, some other tougher people or bigger people or whatever, more technologically sophisticated people, whatever it is, are going to take that area. I've often thought, for example, that the Assyrians in the very, very old world, as we like to call it, in ancient times, they lived in a version of their little node of civilization that made them sort of the Germany of their location, right? You know, dangerous, warlike, numerous people around them in all directions, frontiers that are not easily defensible, that kind of thing. Same sort of deal. You figure if that people hadn't been warlike, they're going to be replaced by people who are. So I really wanted to look a little bit into that whole idea. And, you know, Tacitus played right into it, just like a bazillion other writers have, that some people are warlike and you can classify them as warlike people. I mean, look at the Apache Indians, the Native Americans in the American Southwest, and they're warlike. And you look at the Hopi or the Zuni people or the Pueblo people in the same region, and they're peaceful. What accounts for one being one way and one the other? And are those legitimate sort of labels, or is there something else at work? I might not be qualified to really delve into that. That's more of a just asking questions with no answers kind of deal. But I find it fascinating. And the reason to bring it up when you try to explain the idea of Frankish heavy cavalry is because there's this element that it's more than just equipment and training and whatnot that goes into making knights, certainly, but these proto-knights also, so incredibly dangerous at the tactical level. This is what I mean, folks. We're going to get a little military here, and I hope it's okay. But this is something I love to talk about. I mean, for example, I think most people who pay any attention to this understand that, you know, knights are one of the great weapons systems of the pre-modern world. And there's a tendency, I think, in some people to look at the knights and say, okay, well, here's what this is. It's a guy on a big horse, although that's debatable with more modern evidence. Maybe a guy on a bigger horse with armor, almost certainly, with stirrups, which is something people make a very big deal out of. I would be one of those people that would suggest there's too much of a big deal made of stirrups, that people seem to do wonderfully well with cavalry, including cavalry with lances, long before there were any stirrups. So I'm not so sure it's as big of a deal as people think. What's more, there were saddles made from wood that would often have things like four pommels, you know, one on each side and then one in front and one on back, that stabilized you in a way that we often assume you would need stirrups to be stabilized, right? And those sort of things deteriorate with time. So you don't find a lot of those things in, you know, graves or museums. Nonetheless, when you look at what's called knightly cavalry, there's something about them that just doesn't explain why they're so feared and why they're so tactically successful. You can go read the Byzantine accounts. There's a famous one from one of their empresses. She said that the Frankish cavalry, and I'm quoting from memory here, could put a hole in the walls of Babylon. Now, if you're a person like me, you want to know why that is. What makes that knightly cavalry so effective? And some people would say, well, you know, the equipment. But other people have had that equipment. Other cavalry throughout history have matched the equipment of the mounted knights, and in fact, to be honest, bettered them, you know, two or three or four times over in terms of, you know, training and organization and discipline. Why can't you just take a knight in a knight's armor with a knight's weapons and make them a Byzantine instead and train them better and have them be even better? I don't know, but it didn't work out that way. The Byzantines themselves figured the situation out and understood it in a way that maybe ancient peoples understood better than modern peoples, without any qualms about labeling one people peaceful and another people warlike. They simply went out and hired these people. They did the same things that the earlier Romans had done, right? You look at these people, you see, wow, these people are good fighters. Let's hire some of them. And earlier on in their history, the Byzantines hired a royal guard. They were called the Varangian Guards, and these were supposedly Swedish Vikings is the way that they originally portrayed themselves. But it became sort of a recruiting deal where the Byzantine recruiters would take any of these northern people. And one of my favorite stories about this wild group of royally clad Byzantine axemen who were all tall and blue-eyed and blonde and that whole barbarian biker image, what I like about them is you could find people who were famous in the Viking, you know, or Anglo-Saxon world that end up serving a little time with the Byzantines. Some of the people who were involved in the incidents in 1066 when the Normans invaded the Saxons and that whole thing went down found themselves in Byzantine service later and, in one of my favorite stories from this period, ended up fighting the Normans again when the Normans who were down in Italy causing all sorts of interesting things to occur, ran into the Byzantines, and those same, you know, some of the same people who faced Normans at the Battle of Hastings were facing them again, fighting for the Byzantines this time. Later on in history, the Byzantines will drop the Varangian Guard and hire Normans. Why not? These knightly fighters were fabulous. And there's a part in the, you know, the history fan's mind that goes, why? And you get back, if you're going to take this way of looking at it, to this idea of a warlike people and a people who were good at it and reveled in it and took pride in it. It was part of their culture in a way that it's not part of some other people's cultures. Is war a part of the Apache Indian culture the way it's not a part of the Pueblo culture? I don't know. All I know is you couldn't make knights. You couldn't decide knights are great, let's make some. Didn't work that way. And it's not because of the equipment or the training, of which they didn't have much in the way of tactical bodies. They were in small groups called conroys and stuff. They'd 30, 40 of them maybe fighting together in small units. But really, the training that they did was mostly individual. Shouldn't have been hard to recreate, but it was. And you get back to this idea about how much of this involves, you know, warriors that are, you know, warriors on a deeper level than just how they're trained and how they're, you know, equipped. I mean, why were the mounted European knights so incredibly tactically dominant during the Crusades? They were fighting soldiers that on paper should have been better than they were. And yet, in the few times when the, what were called the Saracen armies, or what the West always called them, but the various armies of the Middle East, sometimes they were Turkish armies, sometimes they were Egyptian armies, but when these armies would run into the mounted knights, if they got caught, which they were at a place like Arzuf by Richard the Lionhearted and his crusaders, if they got caught, they were just done. And I mean done in a way that was just dominating. Done in a way that takes you right back to those Byzantine military manuals that says stay away from the Franks, you know, if they're at full strength and you're dealing with them, you know, head to head. These crusaders of a couple of hundred years later, descendant from these societies that had been taken over by, you know, warrior Germanic societies, brought some of that with them. In the old days, before it was politically incorrect, they used to talk about the Normans fusing, you know, their French, I guess. French was the way I think some of the early historians portrayed it. Their French blood with the blood of the wild and warrior Northmen from the Viking lands, creating a hybrid sort of human being. That's almost, you know, Island of Dr. Moreau stuff now. You know, that's almost like genetic engineering. It's uncool to even talk about that. And I don't have an answer. I don't even have a theory other than, you know, somehow it looks like, you know, let me back up. I read a book that was fabulous and interesting. I don't think the author is the most entertaining, but the subject is out of control interesting, and it's called Before the Dawn. And it's a book written by a journalist who's trying to look at the latest DNA evidence on human history and synthesize so far what's known and try to tell you about it. There was one part where he talked about a completely politically incorrect subject that reminds me of this, and it had to do with Jewish intelligence. Now, of course, there are stereotypes, positive and negative, of the famous Jewish intelligence or cleverness or whatever you want to name. One of these days I'm going to do a show on the Jewish people because they are fascinating. How such a small people can have so many individuals taking up any decent book of the top 100 most influential people of all time. I mean, that's fascinating. But this Before the Dawn book had pointed out that, you know, IQ tests, take that for what it's worth, but that IQ tests had supposedly showed that a certain segment of the Jewish population, the Jews of Europe, were smarter than average and smarter than other Jews. Smarter than the Jews that stayed in the Middle East, smarter than the Jews that were over in, you know, Spain. And the theory is that these Jews are essentially, you could almost call it a historical karmic payback for discrimination and anti-Semitism. These Jews were only allowed in certain kinds of professions. At least this is the theory the book postulated. And that those professions often involved, you know, increasing mental workloads of hard calculation, number crunching, all kinds of things, generation after generation. And what the book was saying is that it's just another example of, you know, short-term evolution, evolution happening in 10 lifetimes or 20 lifetimes or, you know, something within, you know, some time frame that we can say, wow, you know, from the year zero to the year 1600, all of a sudden you see an increase in intelligence among this one population in Europe, this ethnic group that's not allowed to do menial chores or anything but hard calculation. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but you get my point. And what the author had said is that the theory is that it's because of that, because if you look at Jews elsewhere in the world who did not have such limitations on what they could do, for example, in Spain, you don't see that same DNA marker that indicates a higher IQ level or whatnot, nor do you see it in Islamic societies in the Middle East where Jews were required to do menial labor, right? They were not allowed to do anything but janitorial work or housework or those kind of things, and you don't see the intelligence increase there either. I brought that up not to talk about, you know, Jewish intelligence, but to point out that if something like that is true, I think it opens up the door, doesn't it, to this idea that if you do something generation after generation after generation, if your culture codifies it and rewards it, if there's a weeding out process where people who aren't good at this get weeded. I mean, if the Germans are all going to war all the time because they fight all the time and you're a weak, non-warlike German, but you're in the front lines, what's the likelihood of you passing on your genes to the next generation? I have no answers, but I'm fascinated by these questions. Is there something in the DNA of knights that made them so tactically dominant? And of course, then you have to ask the reverse question, right? And wonder if there's something in the DNA of knights that made them so strategically inept, because that's how people beat them. Otherwise, why didn't knights conquer the world, right? They didn't conquer the world because the chances of them actually getting on a battlefield in good shape and catching their enemy is small. Unless that enemy happens to be knights as well. The Mongols took them apart. The knights lost most of the battles in the Crusades. The battles that they did the best on were sieges. And the notable successes like Arzef are few and far between. The Byzantines basically say you can defeat them all these different ways. Just make sure you don't fight them, you know, head to head when they're in good shape. Make sure they're tired or starving or ready to go home or depleted in numbers, or you hit them in the flanks and rear, or you just tire them out and shoot arrows at them and never let them catch you. Just don't face them head to head, right? Because the Byzantines themselves understood there's something about these people that's irresistible. I'd love to know what that is. By the way, if you have any suggestions, I'd love to hear them. In any case, the point of bringing that up is because before you have knights with all this tactical dominance, you have the Frankish proto-knights with very much the same thing. You know, in the same way that knights will continue to evolve and get heavier armor and become even more, you know, nasty on the tactical battlefield, these, you know, early Frankish heavy cavalry are essentially performing the same fact. They're not quite as effective, they're not quite as heavy, but in the time period that they run in, they're extremely effective. This is why Charlemagne loses so few battles, even though that heavy cavalry could be countered by infantry. The Vikings, for example, were known to, you know, stop while on foot and turn around and deal with Frankish cavalry sometimes, although the reverse happened as well. Carolingian armies were based around this cavalry. The heavy cavalry of the Carolingian armies was the striking arm. It was the one that was relatively mobile, It was the one composed of the highest quality troops and the ranking elites. And, you know, as modern historians would point out, many of the people who had a stake in the system, the kind of people who, if they ran away, as was very common in ancient and medieval battles, would have the most to lose, either in terms of reputation or anything else. And the way the Franks did things was the way a lot of tribal societies do in terms of organization. As we said, they would organize units based on loyalties. And so the guy next to you was likely to be someone from your hamlet or village, someone you knew, and whose conduct in the battle one way or the other you would know about. If you're just some average guy he's never seen before and he'll never see again, he doesn't care so much what his conduct in battle looks like. This was a way to create a, you know, common bond that otherwise might not exist. In places like the legions and more modern professional militaries, you did that with unit cohesion over long periods of time. You would develop a unit esprit de corps. These medieval armies and these Dark Age armies were such ad hoc affairs, you know, thrown together for the campaign season, and then everybody goes their merry way, that you couldn't, you know, rely on sustained bonds. The only kind of bonds you were going to have are the ones you brought to the battlefield with you. So you brought people you already had those bonds with. A lord with his family members, extended even, and their retinues, who they personally paid and knew, and their subjects and villagers and peasants or what have you, all on the same battlefield and sort of under the watchful eye of their own authority and the people that they would have felt some sort of, you know, allegiance to. Now, the Carolingian cavalry was supplemented by foot troops. As we said, Charlemagne tried to create a corps of archery in his army, something that would have, as we said, helped him against the steppe nomad people that they were fighting in what's now, you know, Central and Eastern Europe. But more than that, it was maybe, some modern historians have suggested, a way for Charlemagne to figure out a way to make what was quickly becoming a bunch of useless foot troops useful again. The infantry of this time period in the Carolingian army reminds you of the infantry in Anglo-Saxon England, you know, known as the Ferd, or also known as the Ferd, the Scandinavian, your average people in the Scandinavian area, the villagers, the Bondi, those kind of people. And varying degrees of effectiveness would be a good way to put it. Immobile on the battlefield unless they were charging and happy to do that. Otherwise, a big shield wall would probably be created and they would form a solid body that the cavalry could rally behind if necessary, who could finish off things, who could pose a threat on the battlefield that kept the opposition from maneuvering in certain ways. If you have a giant body of infantry, you know, 100 yards in the distance, you can't feel totally comfortable presenting your flank or whatnot to them so that you could, you know, get an advantage on someone a lot closer to you. You have to be cognizant of the fact that they're there, even if they're not moving and even if they're not shooting at you. That's still a lot of mouths to feed and a lot of disruption of the communities and everything else to justify getting all those foot troops out there if they're not going to be more useful than that. And that's maybe why Charlemagne wanted them to carry bows, figuring, hey, I can make that immobile wall of troops a heck of a lot more effective if they can reach out and touch the enemy in a way that, you know, they can't right now. The Carolingian armies didn't often have to fight battles on the battlefield. Most of the time, their ability to feed and supply and this logistics train we talked about allowed them to create situations where the enemies they were going to fight simply melted away in front of them or locked themselves up in fortified cities or towns or whatnot, which is why the Carolingians were more commonly involved in siege operations. And they became one of the really good armies at siege operations, which, of course, any successful army during this period had to be, because it was just too easy to say, to heck with that, I'm not fighting that. We'll just lock ourselves up in the city and wait till their army starts to get hungry or a disease or, you know, it's time to bring in the harvest or whatever it is, and they melt away. Now, the foot troops in the Carolingian army, you know, in this period of around 800 or 900 ADCE, in some ways they remind you of the old Merovingian armies, because the old Merovingian armies were almost entirely foot troops. The difference would have been probably in terms of individual fighting quality. The great mass of Merovingian infantry would have probably been very similar on the battlefield to the great mass of Carolingian infantry, although those people would have more likely been warriors and fighters in a warrior culture more than what was happening by Carolingian times when the warrior culture element was confined to an elite group of what we would call today proto-knights. Back in Merovingian times, the warrior nature of the society percolated down to a much more individual warrior level. Remember that story we told about Clovis having to share some of the loot equally with his warriors that he took while he was still a pagan, rampaging around the churches of central France. That's the Merovingian era. By the Carolingian era, most of those people are expected to just, you know, work for their lord and do whatever they're told, and it's the proto-knights that get most of the hard lifting done when it comes to warfare. Now, Frankish armies had been infantry armies when the Romans first encountered them. Famous infantry armies, by the way. When the Romans were fighting the Franks, there was almost no cavalry at all. The Franks would line up in these dense, unwieldy masses of troops, these big blocks of people, where the only organization in Merovingian times often, at least what's come down in the sources, was for people to gather around their particular lord or count or the person that had brought them to the battlefield. In other words, some count from Austrasia brings people over, and everybody who came with him stands by him and his flag or his insignia on his part of the battlefield. And then there'll be a little space probably between his unit and the unit next door where the, you know, count of Aquitaine brought his troops, right? And then the old Merovingians were famous for having a weapon that supposedly is the reason they're called, you know, Franks at all. It's called the Francesca or the Francesca. And this is a famous Frankish throwing axe. And apparently, if you believe the sources, the Franks were famous for waiting with their throwing axe until just the right time. And then all on one, you know, command, throw their axes all at once. And they were supposed to be really good at it. And then right after you throw the axes, of course, you charge right into the mass of people you just disrupted and disordered by throwing them. You know, thousands of axes or hundreds of axes at them all at once and try to take advantage in their lines of disruptions and openings in the ranks that can be pushed open even farther and whatnot. Merovingian armies are reported as being tough, but simplistic and simple-minded and relatively immobile. Once they started to move, you know, the whole organization of the line and everything just collapsed. So if they started to move and didn't hit something right away, someone's cavalry was going to mess them up badly. They didn't use missile weapons much other than those axes at all. And this is one of the things Charlemagne tried to remedy. Again, it shows almost a cultural issue. He tried to get the Franks to take up the use of the bow because the bow would have been really helpful with some of the enemies that the Franks were facing. For example, all those Eastern horse archer peoples that were continually changing. You know, you go from the Huns to the Avars to the, you know, Magyars and all these people. You know, we're using a lot of archery and we're very tough to catch. You'd like to have a little archery yourself. Charlemagne makes it a rule that you're going to take up archery. It didn't work. Again, showing that these are almost cultural questions sometimes. If something doesn't take hold, even if you mandate that it has to happen, although the British are supposed to have taken up the longbow that way, you wonder if there are cultural elements at play, like maybe this bow is a nasty weapon that could take down a noble who's put a ton of training into, you know, making them who they are, and they have lots of money, and they're powerful, and some idiot with a bow can take them down. We may just put the damper on these bows. At least that's the way the reticence of some of these more heroic combat societies to take up the bow was always explained. Same reason samurai, for some of the history of Japan, didn't much like guns. Too much power in the hands of a commoner who can now kill an exquisitely trained and equipped, you know, soldier without that training or equipment or social breeding or anything. Not always the coolest of thoughts for, you know, the elite of the society to deal with, especially these earlier societies. They were not so very democratic about who got to kill them or not. One of the things I had wanted to point out in the program and never got a chance to was, you know, the sophistication of these societies. Here we did a whole show talking about the Statue of Liberty, you know, being toppled and them trying to bring it back and never quite achieving anywhere near the levels that the Roman Empire could have, right? Yet what they could achieve still boggles the modern mind when you realize, I mean, you're looking at what used to be called the Dark Ages. This is a bad period in medieval history in terms of capabilities. And you look at Charlemagne and his Frankish armies on campaign, though, and it blows you away what our early forefathers were capable of putting together, you know, without computers and without motor vehicles and gasoline and all that stuff. Listen to this one segment. I wanted to get into this. Alessandro Barbero wrote a rundown of the Frankish army on campaign and what was required in terms of logistics and supplies, and didn't make it into the other show. I wanted to make it into this one because, boy, does it give you an idea of, you know, what these people were capable of and what going to war required. So when you say, well, the Franks went to war 33 years straight, well, listen to what that means, quoting from the Alessandro Barbero book, Charlemagne, Father of a Continent. Now, Barbero here is talking about the Frankish army on campaign, especially against the wild Saxon people, for example, where you were going into Indian country. And the part I like about this, too, is you can hear how much people like the Carolingians, hundreds of years after Rome's fall, still rely on the Roman roads to get around from place to place. And when the Roman roads sort of run out, you have no roads at all. Quote, "The military columns stretched out for many miles along the Roman roads that crossed the empire before entering enemy territory on roads that were often considerably worse or even non-existent. The enormous size of these columns was mainly due to the baggage trains. The common two-wheeled cart, pulled by a yoke of oxen, was capable of carrying half a ton of flour, barely a day's ration for 500 men. The ration for 1,000 men over a 3 months campaign was therefore 180 carts and 360 oxen. Then there was the wine, which at the time was routinely drunk by all sections of society and constituted an important supplement of calories. Given that a cart could carry 130 or 160 gallons, the same 1,000 men would need another 180 carts on the campaign. Every day a horse would require about 22 pounds of fodder, of which half could be grass or hay, but the other half would have to be barley or oats. Over 3 months, 100 horses would therefore consume the loads of another 90 carts. This is not counting the carts that transported arms and equipment, or the provisions required for the long journey from the men's own country to the assembly point where operations would begin. The calculation," he writes, "is quite straightforward. A force of about 12,000 men, of which perhaps 3,000 would be on horseback, would be accompanied at the moment it entered enemy territory by more than 6,000 carts, pulled by 12,000 oxen." End quote. So 12 or 15,000 men, probably at a minimum, with all those oxen, 12,000, which 15,000. I mean, you think about the carts stretching off into the distance. How 6,000 of these carts lined up, you know, head to tail. How long of a supply line is that? And imagine doing that with the tools available to a medieval people who had few people who could even write with that army. It's astounding. It reminds me, like I said, about that whole line about the one historian who had suggested that we not judge ancient people based on what they couldn't do, but about what they managed to accomplish anyway, right? We said, you know, don't judge them on losing the internet and not having an internet, but on how they managed to continue in the world without one. Same thing with these people. You can't say that the Romans would have done it so much better and the Romans were putting more men in the field and even had bigger supply lines. The Romans had stuff going for them these people didn't have. In the middle of, you know, a really low developed age, the Frankish armies could put that kind of an effort into the field. It boggles the modern mind. And it wasn't just the ability to organize or write or any of that that, you know, helps make this such an amazing achievement, what they could put into the field. You have to remember, monetarily speaking, this is a period sort of in flux. There's a little bit of money floating around, and Charlemagne and the Franks have some of it, and there's certainly some money from Byzantium that makes its way even into Viking hordes up in Scandinavia. Arabic money finds its way there, too. So there's money around, but it's not really a money economy. The Frankish and Western European economy in this time period relies so much on, you know, kind rather than cash, and it creates all sorts of interesting, you know, sort of angles. For example, it reduces labor back to its most basic element. Like if you read Marx or any of the economists who talk about all wealth in terms of the labor of individuals, you can see that in, you know, this world between the real Middle Ages and the end of the Roman Empire, because you can measure the value of the king's holdings or the emperor's holdings by how many people they have working for them, creating stuff. So, for example, you'll often read, when you're reading this stuff, about how many monasteries were under the king's command and that owed how much of whatever they produced, whether it's wine or bread or grain or anything, how much they owed to the central authority. In addition, when I was a lot younger, this whole period was portrayed as being a period where slavery, in the old Roman sense or the old Greek sense, had given way to something called serfdom. Well, a lot of the new writings point out that, no, there are still slaves, and they're all over the place, and a lot of these slaves work for both the church and for the king or the emperor. And part of how you could measure his wealth was to say something, as Barbero did, that the Carolingian state could call on the labor and the products of the labor of 500,000 peasants and slaves who were working on what was called crown land. In other words, instead of the people working for a lord who was like a middleman who would take some of their stuff and then, you know, give what the king required to the king, these peasants and slaves worked directly for the crown, and their entire take beyond what they needed to live went right to the crown. So they didn't get cash most of the time. They got stuff. They got wine. They got food. They got horses, you know, whatever. And the way you could measure what this state could bring to bear in fighting wars or governing or whatever, its natural resources available to it, the main one that's cited during this time period instead of money is how many people you have working and how much of that labor goes into the state coffers. Again, without money, you think about the military achievements of the Carolingians and you just wonder how they were able to put it together. It reminds you that people have lots of different ways they can solve problems. If you close off the traditional methods we would normally think of, right? Well, first you get a lot of computers together and you write this. You know, these people just had to do it differently. They made it work. And it just shows how, you know, how clever we always are. I always like to point out that, you know, we can be more intelligent than our forebears in terms of knowing more real information, you know, how many planets there are, how we focus around the sun, all these things. We can know more real info, and we can be wiser in some respects, although I doubt in all respects. We also have the ability to access information from people who, you know, are dead and gone. The group intelligence that the internet lets us harness, or that libraries used to let us harness, you know, ancient people often didn't have that at their disposal, but they're always as clever as we are. See, that's the thing. Innate human cleverness probably hasn't changed much at all, and these Carolingians show you very well that there are, you know, more than one ways to skin a cat, as the old saying went, and they do it in a way that just boggles the mind. And if our Statue of Liberty toppled over tomorrow, one wonders if we'd be able to do the same things the Carolingians were able to do without quite a bit of time to relearn how to do them. Finally, the last thing that I wish we had gotten time for was to go more into the Saxon War. There's a whole subplot between Charlemagne and Widukund, a leader that crops up amongst the Saxons who reminds you so much that sometimes you get these leaders of tribal societies that resemble each other. And Widukund reminds you of a Vercingetorix, right, for the Celts that you know, gave a last gasp of Celtic freedom fighting Caesar. And Vercingetorix reminds you of Tecumseh, the famous southeastern Shawnee, I believe Tecumseh was Shawnee, who tried to unite the Native American tribes when it was already really too late into resisting the American colonies. And Widukund gets away, gets forgiven. He's running for his life. He comes back to power. You know, it's a great story. Would have been fun to be able to get into the bishops who actually came from Great Britain and Ireland and parts of northwestern Europe rather than Italy itself, who went in and bravely converted these Germanic tribes. And there are stories, too, that, you know, some of these bishops and whatnot would go to the Germans and they'd say something stupid. You know, you make the wrong move and say something about how they're, you know, the former gods they used to worship, that Thor, those are devils, and get torn to pieces, literally, by the audience that they had been speaking to. How brave are you if you're the bishop who has to replace the guy that with one wrong word got literally torn limb from the people he was trying to convert into members of his flock. It's like turning a flock of wolves into sheep. Better have a really good argument, right? One sort of thing, too, that I should mention that I had to keep reminding myself about during the program, and I need to remind myself about it even now, and you'd be well to keep in mind the same thing, and it has to do with sort of the relative levels of things like morality or hypocrisy in an earlier time period. I'll give you an example of what I mean. All through this program, I thought it was important to bear in mind that often when you would see things, for example, practices of the church that were appalling, the Catholic Church or the Nicene Church, whatever you want to call it, and you have to take yourself out of that a minute and realize that while it's valuable to take these practices out of the time period that they're a part of and look at them now based on our current modern values here, where we are, that's something instructive. It's a little almost like, you know, bringing the alien down here and having him look at it in the third party way. And I try to do this all the time. But that can confuse you too and screw you up mentally. For example, some of the emails I got after the show, you know, talked about church practices that were so nasty, and why didn't you talk more about nasty this or nasty that? And you think to yourself, well, partially because, and this is hard to bear in mind, but I think it casts a cold, hard light on the reality you're dealing with in this very, very violent, unsettling, strange time. Often the church practices, as barbaric and hypocritical and whatnot they may look to our modern eyes, were an improvement over what was being done in society at the time. I tend to be an absolutist about these things, so I completely understand if you are too, but I think we have to bear in mind that to pull someone out of that era, for example, a couple hundred years after this era, right, the Catholic Church, the Western Church, will get upset about the use of crossbows spreading, you know, in the militaries of Western Europe. Now, I'm sure the people in Western Europe thought they invented this contraption, one of the early machines in terms of something on a battlefield. The bow is a machine, but it goes back to Neolithic times. This crossbow was a true, you know, new thing to the Europeans at the time, and they must have thought they invented it, not understanding that the Chinese had crossbows, even repeating crossbows, since ancient times, and the Greeks themselves, the ancient Greeks, had used something called a belly bow, mostly for sieges and whatnot. But it was sort of a rediscovery of old knowledge without these people understanding that they were rediscovering something. And these crossbows were nasty. Even the early ones were nasty. They couldn't reload very fast, but you could put an idiot in charge of it and have them shoot, as opposed to a bowman that, let's be honest, if you want to shoot as a good bowman, you're going to take quite a bit of practice. There's muscles to build up and all these other things. These crossbows could be good and powerful and effective, used by idiots. And they would punch through male armor, which was predominant when they first showed up. And the church issued a ruling that said, you can't use these things. We'll excommunicate leaders who use these things against Christians. And this is where modern, you know, sensibilities get so upset sometimes. Do you realize that they said you can't use a crossbow because it's too evil, but you can use it against the heathen, or you can use it against the Saracens? And I think people don't realize, well, yeah, okay, obviously, you pull these people out of a vacuum. That looks ridiculous to modern eyes. But look at how it's an improvement over what they were doing. This is a call for a higher level of morality, even if it's only against their own kind. You can't blame them if it's not a high enough level of morality. They're still trying to drag a bunch of, you know, Viking types into the idea that you might prohibit the use of a weapon against anybody. Preposterous. Listen to this church pie in the sky thinking they can, you know, mandate the laws of war just by saying you'll excommunicate someone. A lot of church practices are horrific. And so you put them in the context of the time they come from and realize, oh my God, the whole society's horrific. Look at these torturing things that they do. Well, look at the torturing things the civil rulers do. I guess the point is I try very hard to remind myself that in the old line of everything's relative really applies in history. And people need to be judged as much as we can do this and as much as we can throw out human sensibilities, because I am definitely guilty of this myself. We have to try to judge them by the standards of their own times. In other words, imagine these people sitting in front of the old jury of their peers as opposed to a jury of our peers. None of these people are going to come off looking very good in front of a jury of our peers. In front of a jury of their peers, all of a sudden, all the little nuances and all of the differences between behaviors that all look just equally horrifying to us become apparent. I think one of the things that historians have done a very good job doing in modern times, one of the benefits of the so-called scientific historians and the practice of it that way, is they are much better at putting themselves in the place of the people from the time and going, okay, sure, this looks horrible to modern eyes, but how common was it in the day and how would the people living then have perceived it? That's always the hardest part about history, isn't it? Getting into the minds of the people who lived back then, because they are thoroughly different from us. I think it's also the attraction of periods that are more like our period. Eras like, you know, the Greece and Rome eras get a lot of attention because we see ourselves. These Dark Ages are a little bit different. If we really are seeing ourselves in the reflection of the Dark Ages, we can't like very much what we see. Which makes you just want to go back to Greece and Rome, doesn't it? Well, you know, not me. I don't know how many of you people ever want me to go back to Rome, but you get my point. Be ready for some experiments, folks. We warned you. Don't know how you're going to like them, but I hope you'll let me know.
Get more hardcore history at dancarlin.com.